Hello, and thanks for joining me for another episode of Climate Matters, an episode where we continue interviewing mayoral candidates for the Nelson and Tasman electorates. I'm Lindsay Wood, I'm Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and today we have the pleasure of interviewing Richard Osbaston. Richard is standing as a mayoral candidate in both the Nelson and the Tasman electorates, so here's what Richard has to say, first of all, about our first question on the rate of decarbonisation of our economy. Thanks, Richard, for joining us. That's really wonderful to have you on the show. And the first question relates to decarbonisation. It's 4 years since the IPCC 2018 special report signalled a decarbonisation trajectory of a daunting 7.6% year on year from 2020. If we're to be compatible with a 1.5 degree C global warming limit. It's 3 years since our Zero Carbon Act legislated for commensurate responses with subsequent lack of effective action plus regional growth. That's now close to 10% reduction every year. If elected mayor, what would be the key strategies you would put in place to optimise your community's chances of successfully decarbonising at such a formidable rate and on an ongoing basis?
Decarbonisation, that was question one, Lindsay, yeah. And I mean, a great question which sort of encapsulates the whole bigger picture, doesn't it? Which is really what we're all about. And the reason I'm running for six mayoralties and not one as I have done in the past is because the problems that we're facing all have the same root cause, in our humble opinion, but the effects, the results, the symptoms of that root cause come out in myriad different ways. So from droughts to fires to water shortage to poverty to refugees, etc. We know all about the climate change effects. But the point we're trying to make with running for six mayoralties is that we cannot address this locally. And I mean, we've already seen that. There's been, you know, all our lives, Lindsay, we've seen warnings about climate change, you know, with greater and greater increasing urgency. But we've done nothing at all, basically, our whole lives. And now we've got the figures, we've got the data, the parameters that are making it more and more scientifically credible that this is, you know, a sign of serious trouble ahead. And I don't think there's anybody serious that actually doubts that anymore. So that's why we're addressing this, not from a local, oh, we're going to go to electric cars or we're all going to save our milk bottle caps, but that we've actually got to keep burrowing down into this until we get to the actual root cause of why humans are causing so many problems for the climate. And I mean, I'm going to start, you know, right away, Lindsay, with when we've done that, we've ended up with the monetary system itself. And if we don't address the monetary system itself, then none of these problems are fixable. And as we've demonstrated, you know, going from 7.5 to 10% now, we're actually going backwards. We're not even advancing slowly, and we haven't even started to tackle the problems yet. So it really makes it quite, well, certainly to us, obvious that we're going to have to go deeper into our root causes than just addressing symptoms of what's going on. By running for mayor, I mean, at least we get some attention on what that root cause might be. You know, we don't know everything. We try and remain scientific, but you've got to ask the question. And all we've seen in our lifetimes is Band-Aid. I want to say Band-Aid solutions, but they're not even Band-Aid solutions. They're just Band-Aid proposals. And, you know, we've seen nothing in 50 years. So what's to say in the current regime, anything is going to change for the next 50 years, apart from, you know, floods and droughts and, you know, all the effects that we see. As a mayor, one is in a position to at least lead the organization and the community in the right direction. And nobody is currently doing that. They're still on the old trajectory, whereas once we start looking at the opportunities and the potential of a money-free society, there still might be something out there that's worth aiming for. And I see the role of mayor, not of one of knowing the drainage sizes and whose auntie used to own which house, but one as one of leadership and inspiration and vision. And, you know, the mayor should be out there at the very front deciding which direction we are ultimately going to go in. And we need a direction with integrity.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. Now looking to the second question, which deals with our energy future. We're among the most energy profligate societies in history, and much of our greenhouse gas emissions comes from fossil fuels, with transport emissions around 94% of individual emissions in our region. Decarbonising our energy sector is a key to decarbonising our economy, but the logistics are daunting. Electrification of almost everything, New Zealand being especially vulnerable to key global supply chain issues, and the net energy gain of all renewable energy sources, except good hydro, being inadequate to sustain our society in its present form. What do you think the energy future of the region will look like in 25 years, and what would you advocate to prepare our region to make the most of that energy future?
In 25 years' time, with my hand on my heart, with utter sincerity, I can see us being, even with the existing energy resources, the renewable energy resources that we have now, we have abundantly more energy than we truly need. The problem right now, again, on the current money-based trajectory, is that we need more and more energy for more and more pointless purposes. And the majority of our journeys don't even have to be taken. If we really look harshly at this, and I know I'm risking a bit by going into this in too much detail, but when we start considering a resource-based economy, i.e. the type of systems that they use on board spaceships, where they don't have money, they don't have market, they don't have advertising or sales. It all comes down to scientific necessity. Most of what New Zealand produces doesn't even need to be produced. So in 25 years' time, I predict we won't have a dairy industry other than, I mean, in the last election, we calculated, in fact, one of my competitors, a dairy farmer in Greymouth, calculated that two farms his size could supply all the dairy products for the top of the South Island. So we're looking at an industrial base where all our production is voluntary and everything will be provided for free. And when a voluntary philosophy is the basis of your society, people won't volunteer for things that don't have an overall good. Even if they want to, they want to be supported by other people. So you get a genuinely societal-based structure that only does things that have a good for everybody. So as volunteers, we will build hospitals, we will maintain the roads, we will assure a reliable electricity supply, but we won't be expanding dairy, we won't be planting more wine, we won't be having pointless journeys, because everything's voluntary and people don't volunteer for things that have no purpose. So we actually have plenty of energy already. It's just that at the moment we're wasting it and we don't need to be boiling millions of cubic meters of water to make milk powder. Even our forestry, frankly, all our big industries can stop. All the people that are involved in them will be able to retire and they'll still be able to enjoy all the things that their work efforts provide them with now, because those things even now are provided by other people. And the bankers, the accountants, the marketing people, the salesmen, the real estate agents, bless them, they're all doing the best they can, but their efforts don't actually provide anything of tangible value to humanity. So when they're retired, these people, they can still have all those good things, but they didn't contribute to their manufacture anyway, batches, boats, vehicles, etc. That was all done by other people. And a voluntary structure will assure that energy is only used where it's actually necessary by public consent, not where the money says it's needed. And we won't be consuming energy to make money.
Great, thanks. And now we'll move on to the question that deals with a just transition in the application of climate initiatives.
There's a sardonic joke about sea level rise that the poor get moved and the rich get seawalls. While expert Belinda Story would suggest that might not do the wealthy much long-term good, the real point is that disadvantaged people normally become even more disadvantaged as a result of upheaval or crisis. in a climate context, there's frequent reference to striving for a just transition, but global evidence suggests it is largely an unfulfilled aspiration. If you were elected mayor, what would you like your legacy to be in the area of a just transition in climate responses, and how would you go about achieving that?
Basically, in the resource-based economy, the money-free society that we're proposing, you've got to be careful when you say everybody will be equal, because we're not all equal, we're all different, but everybody will have equal opportunity. And to just delve slightly further into how a voluntary society structures itself automatically. Right now, in a money-based, competitive society, the more cunning, ruthless, and psychopathic you are, the better you'll do. So we end up with a society, you know, sort of a pyramid shape, with the most cunning and ruthless and psychopathic at the top, with all the power, all the control, all the luxuries, and all the influence. And so they shape our society in their own model. And so we have a society that is psychopathic, where you have to be cunning and ruthless or you will perish. After money, the thing is completely turned on its head. And because of our technology, we have easily the capacity to produce all the things that we actually need. So energy, housing, good quality food, healthcare, etc. They're not difficult to provide. It's just that money stops us getting at them. They're falsely scarce because of a competitive money system. Once we've got a voluntary society, then, as I said, everyone can have everything that they need for a great life. But the people that stand out, and for sure, we're all different. Some people want to be leaders. Some people want to be prominent. They want to be seen. They want to organize. Some people don't. They just want to be left alone. But the people that are interested in, you know, being pivotal figures, right now, those people on the whole have got there because they've done the most taking. Media barons, you know, high-level politicians, business leaders, they tend to be people that have got to their prominence and positions of authority and influence because they did a lot of taking. And in the future, in our voluntary society, the only way to gain prominence will be by doing more giving. And if you want to stand out, it will be because you've been a fantastic contributor to your society and will be visible for it and recognized and admired for it, and thus will deserve your position of influence. So we end up with a society that's completely the opposite. So right now, if you are gentle and caring and kind and empathetic, you'll end up with nothing. If you are the opposite, you end up with everything.
Thanks again, Richard. Now we go on to the last of the four formal questions, and that is to do with the cost of climate action as against the cost of climate inaction. In reports dealing with climate-related initiatives, there are often comments such as a particular course of action not being cost-effective or not making economic sense, and yet there's almost never reference to the time frame being considered and almost never comparisons with the cost of not taking action, which specialists like Lord Nicholas Stern highlight are generally orders of magnitude greater. This is often exacerbated by the imbalance of high upfront costs being needed to realize longer-term benefits. Over what timescales do you think the costs and benefits of climate action should best be evaluated? And if you were elected mayor, how would you reconcile the often unresolved conflict of prioritizing funds now for benefits over a much longer term?
Great. Okay, part one. Borrow, and I said this, and I've still got the newspaper cutting from 2013, Lindsay, and it was on the front page of the Nelson Mail, and I said to Rachel Rees, who beat me in the mayoral election, do what you have to do as a decent human being. And if that means borrow $150 million on behalf of the people of Nelson, do it, because you will never have to pay it back. The money is made up. It's fake. It's a complete scam. It doesn't even exist. Whereas climate change and its ramifications are real. So the first thing we could do is borrow unlimited amounts of money because it doesn't even exist. And it will all be written off when enough of a critical mass of us get to realize that we've just been scammed for the last 200 years, you know, probably more. So in the short term, borrow whatever we need to do. Don't worry about the cost because we'll never have to pay it back, and we'll do what's actually necessary to be responsible human beings. With the scientific knowledge that we have today and the technology and the equipment that we have, diggers, concrete, you know, scientific research, satellites, etc., we know what to do. And then it all stops when it comes to the pretend tokens that somebody from another country won't let us borrow at ridiculous interest rates. It doesn't make sense. You know, much of this has come from doing school presentations, which I did a lot of, you know, 10 years ago in Nelson Region. And most of the time I just sat down and shut up, Richard, listen to what the 14-year-olds at Nelson College say, because they still think clearly. And it's so obvious to them. We've got diggers, we've got concrete, we've got gravel. Why is it a problem? And it's only a problem when it comes to the pretend token. So that's the first, as regards prioritizing funds, just borrow the money and do it. It's easy. And we will never have to say it back, pay it back. And somebody said it doesn't make economic sense. And I mean, I find having those two words in the same sentence is, well, it would be hilarious if it weren't so tragic. And of course, you know, he's right. The cost of inaction is exponential, isn't it? And so while we argue about these pretend tokens, numbers on a computer screen, we're actually destroying our own future. It's, I don't know, I'm actually lost for words, Lindsay, as how preposterous it is. And it may be at some point that some people, well, I don't blame individuals, this is just the nature of capitalism, but really it's reckless. It's, I would say it's negligent, actually, the harm and the damage that is being done now when we have the information that we could do it a different way makes that unforgivable.
Thanks again. Now we have a final closing opportunity where you get to wave a magic climate strategy wand and tell us what climate strategy you would conjure up with it and why you think it's important.
Thank you for engaging with the questions I've posed. Kindly now imagine that you've been gifted a magic climate strategy wand. If your candidacy is successful and you could conjure up any other single climate-focused council strategy you wished, please tell us what it would be and why you see it as important.
Fantastic. Okay, so I think my magic wand would be we would all 8 billion of us would be just arriving on planet Earth as it was, you know, at the start of the Industrial Revolution, let's say in, I don't know, 1800s. Mm-hmm. And we had all the scientific knowledge and experience and revelations that we have today in the 21st century, but we got to start again. So effectively, we all got on a spaceship like some science fiction movie, and we arrived on this planet. We probably orbited for a while. We looked at the data about the climate and the animals and the biosphere and the psychology of the participants, what it needs to look after it, what it's going to harm it. And then we had an opportunity to sit around a huge table and discuss what's the best way of assuring a decent future for all the participants, now that we understand that the participants also include the bees and the eels and the fish and the women and the children and the Africans and all these things that we've seen as prey are very important as well. You know, we've got this, we're all one now. We realize that every plant, every bit of moss, every molecule of oxygen is just as important as our dominance. And so I think with a modern scientific reset, we'd run our society in a very different way. And then we'd be in a position to appreciate it is actually utopia. This is utopia, heaven on earth, call it what you like, nirvana. We have everything we need for a fantastic life for every single creature, actually, not just humans, but every creature can have a fabulous life without war and famine and crime and violence and stress and misery. Nothing needs to be exploited. Nothing needs to be subservient to anything else. You know, nature was set up beautifully, and now we're just learning what horrific damage we've done to it and what we continue to do, acceleratingly so. But we've got this mindset, which is a wonderful expression, this mindset that we have to use these tokens. But all you have to do is remove the barrier, the toxicity of money, and then everything solves itself. And just going right back to where I started, that structure, the mechanism of a voluntary society actually assures its own success when you really burrow down deep into what happens when you have creatures that, and I think it's fair for me to say, if I may be so bold, Lindsay, that you two probably have a relatively positive opinion of human beings as a whole. Generally, people are kind and generous and sharing and cooperative, but we're forced to fight. We don't want to fight, but we're forced to fight. Our backs are continuously against the wall. But that's not human nature. That's human humans responding to a falsely competitive, scarce environment. And in fact, we have massive abundance. We have incredible resources. And we could all live a totally sustainable, utopic life. And the short version is we could be starting tomorrow. There's nothing in our way. We don't need new technology, new governance systems. Everything is in place. All the hard work has been done. We just need to get the money out of the way, and then we can all be living in paradise. We have a win-win option for every occupant of this planet, and currently we are operating a lose-lose model for every occupant of this planet. It's that distinct. It's Armageddon or utopia.
One of the things that came to mind was when you talked about resource-based economy, well, two things in there. First of all, I'm finding that some engineers, like geological engineers and so on, are saying we can't run a completely circular economy. We have to have something, and they call a resource-based economy one where you have to have some extraction to feed into making things, because you can't do it all in a totally neutral way. So I don't know if you have any comments on that or not. I'd be interested in your take on it.
I do. And yeah, it's funny, people my age and older, and especially people around geology, when you say we struggle for a name for this concept, they all invoke different issues with different demographics. So we've just had to plump for, you know, money-free society, voluntary society, resource-based economy, and just have to, you know, punch on through with it. But we're not talking about the extraction. People tend to think of a resource-based economy is based on the extraction of resources, so we don't mean that. More like the economy that you would use in a spaceship.
Which is the analogy you gave earlier.
Yes, yes. And I would agree with your geologist that you can't have a circular economy at our current rates of consumption. But going right back to the first question, how much of our consumption is actually necessary? How much of it does provide value, as in real human, you know, and ecological terms? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're immediately excluding dairy, forestry, winemaking, you know, some big, heavy, serious industries that do not have to be here. By the time we trim back all those things that, you know, you wouldn't have those on a spaceship. You wouldn't have a marketing department or an insurance department or an accountancy industry or a real estate industry on board a spaceship. It's just not necessary for human survival. You know, these people worked this out over the last 100 years. You know, it's not, we didn't just make this up.
Yeah.
And I just chuck in, you know, my whole career has been spent as a licensed aircraft engineer and an airline pilot.
Okay, I didn't know that.
No, I now teach aircraft engineering, and I've been doing this since I was 16 years old. 42 years ago I started. Mm-hmm. And we talk in absolutes. You know, I'm not, I wish I were, a musician or an artist.
Yeah.
You know, this all. So in the aviation world, and I've been in airline aviation my whole life, we have to have absolutes. We have to assure the future for the traveling public, you know, for the aviation safety has to have a bottom line. We can't just hope for the best like we do with our economies and our industry. Fingers crossed. Let's hope for more tourists next year. You know, we can't base our
future. Or let's hope we can land this plane safely.
Yeah, let's hope the wings don't fall off. Oh, fingers crossed we've got enough fuel. In quality assurance, in ISO 9000, in aviation, you know, hard won 100 years of experience, my whole adult life, the industry has collectively managed to get sufficient data together and operate in a sufficiently reliable way that we can actually assure the future. We can assure that this 777 from Auckland to Los Angeles will arrive there 12 hours later, regardless of anything that this planet can throw at it. And, you know, touch wood, although I'm not superstitious, most of the time it works. In fact, so much so that we're safer on board those aircraft than we are in our own house.
Mm.
That's the level of scientific assurance that humans are capable of giving now.
Mm.
And frankly, to operate a society on the ground is a lot simpler than operating a pressurized metal tube at 500 miles an hour over the Pacific Ocean. You know, that's a very hostile environment, but if we're smart, we can assure the future in that environment.
Mm.
And we can do the same in our real, you know, our ground-based lives as well now, if we respect A, the parameters that we've learned about in our lifetime about carbon production, you know, renewables, human psychology, sociology, the biosphere, global knowledge, all those things that we didn't know about when these systems evolved, let's say. Coming back to a resource-based economy and a circular economy, now that we have those parameters, just as we do with an aeroplane, we can operate very safely within those parameters. And coming back, this is where they kind of overlap each other. Coming back to the voluntary society, if an individual says, well, I want a super yacht and a business jet and three mansions, people are not going to build that for that person as volunteers.
Hmm.
Because we all need some element of those resources to assure we stay within those sustainability parameters. But if we're all living in houses that are built to last, for one thing, I mean, in fact, there's already enough houses in this country. It's just that many of them are empty. And for all sorts of myriad money-based reasons, they're not usable. I mean, just think of all the downtown tower blocks in Wellington or Auckland or Christchurch that are only occupied for a few hours a day by people juggling money. We don't even need any more buildings. So I think that the people that say we can't operate at a circular sustainability level are in anticipation of continuing at our current rates of consumption. And what we're saying is, if we go down to a holistic and sustainable rate of consumption, which at the end of the day, I don't know how many steaks you can eat, Lindsay, but I mean, we don't even eat steak anymore, you know? It's very easy to produce the things that we need. And without all the waste and consumption from capitalism, there's more than enough for everybody. And it could be more than circular. It could be regenerative, actually, easily. You know?
Thank you, Richard. That's great. And another angle on the same thing that's cropped up a bit in recent discussions, and two people you may have come across, you likely know of Mike Ward, who was a councillor at...
we've had some good arguments outside his shop.
Yeah, and I see he's standing again this year. Good on him. And the other one, have you come across Jack Santa Barbara, who is in...
Gough Bay or Motueka?
Yeah, yes. That's right, yeah. Yes. Now, both of them, in slightly different ways, put up a proposal... And I'm interested in your take on this. I'll start with Mike. His concept is that everybody in the country gets given a quota of carbon. Okay? Mm. And so everybody starts on the same base. I've got my 10 tons of carbon or whatever. And what happens then is that you always have to work within your carbon budget. But if you want to go on a trip, you can buy carbon off somebody who doesn't want all of those and do the trading that way. And Mike's pushed that quite hard in ways, and I think it has some basic logic, but I haven't got the operational details at all clear in my head. And Jack Santa Barbara is talking the same sort of thing on an energy basis, that if we all had an energy quota, then we had to live within it or trade with somebody else who said, look, I'll give you some of my plums if you give me some of your energy, sort of thing. I know that's nothing like the system you were talking about, but I'd be interested if you had any comments on those.
I like it. And I like both those guys, actually. They've both been, you know, they're a bit older than I am. And in the early days of resource-based economy, you know, conceptualization, sorry about that, I had some really interesting talks with both of them and Jack's wife as well, and I forget her
Joanna.
Name. Joanna. Yes. Hmm. And, you know, these guys have been busting this stuff for decades, you know. So for me, you know, being a bit younger than them, to come along on their coattails, ride on their shoulders, we're nearly there, Mike and Jack, but we're not quite there yet. You know, and my parents were the same. They're similar ilk, you know, they founded the Green Party in the UK, that kind of thing. And so, you know, we're all on a journey learning from our predecessors.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be, you know, refinement, increasing wisdom and skill and experience. And so this gets hopefully better all the time. You know, that's the process of evolution.
Yeah.
And we are, you know, as a species, we're an emergent species. We're not a fixed entity. This is all changing all the time. So this is all very healthy. My issue with both those proposals is that we're still using a form of currency. And it's, I mean, they're much better than dollars. But at the end of the day, I'm just thinking, wow, if I want to go on a long trip, I could force my daughter into prostitution and get some extra credits.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you've got a reason for exploitation and toxicity and corruption. And the more credits I hold, I mean, what somebody who's, I don't know, you could even get credits for producing methamphetamine.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it doesn't have to be valuable. If you can trick somebody or get somebody addicted, you'll get the credits out of them. And it's just the same, frankly, with green dollars or time banking. It's still an intermediate false value system applied to nature. You know, real, genuine, unencumbered nature is humans and resources and technology. And that's all they take to space. And we are in space. We're just on a bigger spaceship.
You're right. The idea of spaceship Earth has been kicked around for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. I'm a massive fan of Buckminster Fuller, and he saw this in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And it was so obvious, but of course, you know, he had to let capitalism and car manufacturing and tobacco and everything else go run their course. And now they're running their course, and it's the next phase.
So, and I remember one of Buckminster Fuller's mantras I remember was, he was very conscious of what he called the haves and the have-nots, wasn't he? And he said, we've lived all of humanity with the haves, i.e. the wealthy people, being outnumbered by the have-nots. But he said, we're switching, that balance is shifting now, where the very comfortably off people will outnumber the poor people, and that will throw a big spanner in the works.
Yeah.
Have you got time for one other digression from me?
Yeah, go on, go for it. Yes.
I don't know whether you've come across a guy called Tim Morgan who runs a website called Surplus Energy Economics.
No.
And the reason I'm wanting to raise that is I'm sure a lot of what he says will probably rub you up the wrong way, because he's steeped in conventional economics, but he's very strongly rooted in the principle that it's energy that drives the economy, not the economy that demands energy. And he often writes with the concept of money as being a token for value. And in a way, you were talking about that when we were just talking about carbon or energy. You were saying, well, okay, they're better than money, but they're still just a representative of some. And so I just thought I'd mention that in case that held any interest, or whether you wanted to comment at all before I let you finish your lunch.
Thanks. No, I've never heard of him, but it's interesting. But my alarm bells go off. I've been pushing this for nearly 15 years, and you know, I first ran for mayor in 2013, so I sort of went public at that stage. And, you know, I left school at 16. I never went to university. I don't know how to put a thesis together or pursue a doctorate. So, you know, part of my farming, growing up on a farm culture, and absolutely my aviation culture, is if you don't know, ask. That's enormous in aviation, you know. And I teach here now. You know, I've got 12 students I'm going back to in a minute. And they start from scratch. And one of the absolute baseline fundamentals is, if you don't know, you ask. A, because someone else will know. And B, we don't want any mistakes. We cannot have those things plopping into the ocean. And so what's happened with the concept of resource-based economics is that every time we've reached a stumbling block or a potential showstopper, we've asked. And so I must have asked nearly everybody in the top of the South Island, you know. And of course, now with the internet, we've had the capacity to share this with people all over the world. And there's lots of other money-free promoting organizations out there, but they don't have what I call the New Zealand factor with Māori Queen's chain, you know, our the nature of New Zealand society. Every time we've had a problem, we've always asked, and we've asked the people, and it sounds a bit cliched, but we didn't make this up in some highfalutin academic institution. This comes from talking to school children and people like Jack and Mike Ward and yourself. That's where all this came from, and we've just kept at it. And every time we've had a problem, we've asked. So going back to your Tim Morgan proposal, anything that involves anything other than humans, physical resources and technology, I'm suspicious of. And any energy trading tokens, I feel, oh, I don't know, there's shiny people with pointy shoes in suits who are going to capture that market. And in the voluntary free society that we're talking about, you cannot corrupt it, because you need other people and nature actually to support your activity if you're going to get any significant push behind it. One person just cannot do much on their own. You'll get the odd nutter, but people won't support it. Even if you and I decided, oh yeah, we're going to build a Coca-Cola factory in Nelson because we think Coke's great, I don't know what your wife would say about it. My wife would say, oh, sit down, you know. Don't be ridiculous. My children would say, Dad, haven't we been against this kind of thing our whole life?
Yeah, yeah.
And the same goes for the people who supply the vehicles and the concrete and the buildings and the architecture. You just won't get a society to support something that's no longer healthy. And now that we know what healthy actually means, everybody knows what's healthy. And it's not Coca-Cola, it's not milk, it's not wine, and it's not tobacco, you know? And we don't need Mickey Mouse tokens controlled by some entity overseas or anywhere else.
Well, thanks, Richard. That's been great that you joined us and shared your views with us. It's very much appreciated. And you had some very interesting comments.
Okay. Really appreciate it. Good on you.
Thank you.
Cheerio.
Now, as always, I will give you details of how you can listen. And the best bet for you is to go onto the Resilience website at www.resilience, that's R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-Z, resilience.co.nz. And there you will find links that go to the podcast page, where there's a whole lot of information and a whole choice of podcasts for you to listen to. And on that note, I will thank you for your company. I hope we enjoy it again for future podcasts. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.